Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. We've been following the Gospel according to St. Luke, and today we're going to look at Luke chapter 14, verse 1, and then verses 7 through 14. It's a familiar story to us, a story about the places of honor at banquets and so forth. But it has within it a very profound lesson for all of us, because all of us have the tendency to fall into kind of normal behavior that doesn't really reflect the difference in a human life that faith in Jesus Christ should really make. And so it says that on the Sabbath day, Jesus had gone for a meal to the house of one of the leading Pharisees, and they watched him closely. There's no indication here that they drew him into the banquet in order that they could criticize him or critique him, but certainly they were kind of interested in what he would do and what he was like. He was kind of a mystery to many, many people. And when there's someone is very mysterious, there's always kind of the tendency to say that we should, maybe it would be interesting to get to know them a little bit better, to find out kind of what makes them operate, what goes on inside of them. So certainly it would be as much out of curiosity as it would be out of friendliness that they would invite Jesus to the banquet. And as he goes into the banquet, he began to notice that people were jockeying for positions. And it says he told the guests, therefore, a parable. And this is interesting, too. He's a guest in the home of a well-to-do Pharisee. And there is a lot of interesting people, but friends, family, other Pharisees, wealthy neighbors, and so forth, who have been invited to this banquet that Jesus is attending. Yet he has the position, somehow or other, to be able to kind of give a lesson, a teaching, at the table. And so we can presume in some way, shape, or form that he is being brought into this particular social gathering in order to make a contribution to it, in order for them to maybe hear some of what he has to say. There's no indication that this was done to try and trap him, as they often try to do, nor is there any sense there's any hostility in all of this. But Jesus begins to comment on the seating arrangement in the banquet itself. And this is something that, first of all, might strike us as strange, because we usually have a tendency to be very informal in our meal settings. At a wedding reception, for instance, or in some other formal occasion, we might have name cards. There might be kind of a protocol for where people sit on special occasions. But in the ancient Oriental world, any meal kind of was subject to this kind of protocol. And there were so many different ways to judge who was to sit where that while certainly there were certain people who took precedence, there were many who had to kind of find for themselves where they fit in the social order, the social hierarchy of the banquet that they were attending. And so it would be, for instance, like taking our idea of a wedding reception or a formal reception of some kind, and expecting people then to arrange themselves according to their status within the community with which they were attending, something that would not be very easy to do. And Jesus, therefore, simply says, you know, well, the safest thing to do is go to the last place. And because then, if you're out of order, you can only go up from there. Whereas if you go to a place too high for your station, you'll be put back. And that's a humiliation to be able to be told, you know, well, you have to leave the number one table and go back to the number eight table or some such thing. And so basically, it's a practical little lesson in just saving face and a practical lesson in social graces. But there's something more and underneath it all that Jesus wants to emphasize. He's not giving an etiquette lesson, and he's not giving a lesson that that in any way is attempting to address the social situation of ancient Israel. He's just not doing that. But what he's doing is he's talking about life. And this becomes really important then, because life itself actually is a social event. It is a social gathering of the peoples of communities, of peoples of the earth, in the banquet of the living God. And for Isaiah portrays this very powerfully in his story on the banquet on the holy mountain and so forth. The whole idea of God's relationship with his people is seen as a great precursor to the great heavenly banquet foretold in the prophecies, particularly of Isaiah. And Jesus uses the meal, as we know, in the confection of the Eucharist, in the institution of the Eucharist. The meal is probably kind of a central part of the human story of the human understanding of social behavior and so forth. It morphs, it changes. We've gone from the very formal Sunday dinners of several decades ago to different kinds of social gathering around food and drink and so forth. But the institution basically remains there as a means of how people encounter each other, how people discourse, how people gather with friends and family and so forth. And so what happens then is that Jesus is using this very essential component of human behavior to talk to us about what goes on inside the human mind and what goes on inside the human heart. And so he says then, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and the man who humbles himself will be exalted. Now, humbling ourselves does not mean demeaning ourselves. It's not demeaning, even in his image of the banquet, it's not demeaning to go to a lower place. We may belong there, very honestly, but it's not a self-deprecation. It's not demeaning. What it really is if you go to the place where you belong, then what you are doing is being honest about where you belong within the society that you are a part of, where your standing is, where your status is, however that society is structured. Certainly in the ancient Near East, there was a very rigid protocol about that that really defined places. We certainly know that class was a very important part of the development of life in medieval Europe, and we know that it even came very clearly into the Victorian era. But we also know that the American Revolution was in some way, shape, or form an attempt to create a society that was not based on class. The more radical revolutionary position in that, of course, was the Bolshevik Revolution. By denying the naturalness of division of talents and positions and so forth, it created a revolution, but it also created a new class structure and failed in its attempt, therefore, to create a classless society. So I think that probably we might be able to say that the American Revolution was probably the most successful social experiment in modifying the notion of a class structure within a society. Although in the very beginning they did try to do that on the basis of material well-being, material goods. And so that, for instance, in the original proposals in the Constitutional Congress, there was a provision that enfranchisement, the right to vote, depended upon a citizen having at least a 200-shilling freehold, so that because they were considered, they would not be really invested in the democratic process if they didn't have a stake in the game, and the stake in the game had to be for them private property of some kind. So even though we in the American Revolution attempted to undo the class structures of old Europe, that we still ended up with class structures nonetheless, only modified and more fluid and ambivalent than they had been in the past. But in the ancient Near East, these were very rigid categories, as they were, for instance, in Victorian England or in many parts of the world, even today, in tribal structures and so forth. There's hierarchies. And even in the American Indian tribal structures, there also were hierarchies of persons. So it seems to be kind of a natural tendency of the human person to create certain kinds of hierarchies. Yet at the same time, Jesus is saying that to be the last may make it possible for us to become the first. So what does he mean by that? Certainly there is in last Sunday's gospel, or in the gospel concerning the coming from the east and from the west, there is once again tribute paid to the Gentiles, indicating that, you know, Israel, because it has been unfaithful to the covenant, will be replaced by the peoples of the earth, the peoples from the east and the west and the north and the south. And then he says there also, the first will be last and the last will be first. Here he says, whoever exalts himself will be humbled, whoever humbles himself will be exalted. It's part of the whole pro-Gentile agenda or idea that moves through St. Luke's gospel. The opening up of the kingdom, the opening up of the kerygma, to the peoples of the earth. But Jesus is meaning also something more than just the inclusion of the Gentiles into salvation. He's also talking about something personal within the human person, something very important. And that centers around what is called the virtue of humility. And we say to ourselves, well, what is this? Humility very often is interpreted as being denying those talents which we do have, lest we appear to be bragging about them. It sometimes appears to be denigrating ourselves and placing ourselves intentionally maybe lower than others so that there are fewer expectations of us and fewer demands upon us. There are also those, and humility is not necessarily associated with being at the lower end of the social scale, because that can be filled also with envy and jealousy and anger and all of those kinds of things. So basically, what is humility? And I think that that's where this banquet image becomes very important for us, because the banquet image says this about the people who take their seat at the banquet. Be honest about who you are. If you belong in the middle of the banquet, then sit there. If you belong at the end of the banquet, sit there. If you belong in the front of the banquet, sit there. Be honest about who you are. Now, he's not talking about class in this. He's talking about the individual human person's capacity to know themselves and to be honest about themselves and to accept not only their own strengths but their own weaknesses. And this is something that is very, very difficult, I think, for us to comprehend. For humility is at its very essence truth. Now, if we do not know who we are, we cannot be truthful about who we are. We can develop grandiose ideas of how wonderful we are, or we can be very depressed and self-deprecating about, well, I'm just a real loser, I can't do this, everybody else can do something more than I can do, they're better than I am at this, they're better than I am at that. I'm kind of, you know, one of the world's losers. Neither one of those things has anything to do with the truth of who the human person is. For the human person is created in the image and the likeness of the divine. The human person is a participant in the divine being. And so the human person always is a person of honor and is always a person oriented toward goodness. On the other hand, the human person suffers from the effects of original sin and from the effects of the sinful environments in which they may live, and in fact, in their own story of personal sin and personal failure. These have to become very much a part of our self-understanding. St. Bernard, once again, I quote him often on this, St. Bernard says, no one can know themselves unless they know their origin and their destiny. In other words, unless they are aware of the Creator and aware of the destiny for which we were created, they cannot know who they are as a human person. And they are left to interpret them for themselves, their whole meaning of life, their whole purpose. Without faith and without a knowledge of the presence of the living God, we do not know who we are. And I think that we find that within contemporary society, all of the news now that, you know, that 25% or more than, and 40% of young people don't believe in God or don't believe in, well, you know, that's kind of a funny thing to say. We ask the question, what don't they believe in? They don't believe in the God that they have heard of. They don't believe in the God that someone else has told them about. Or they really do have this vacant place inside of them as far as their origin is concerned, and that they are therefore rooted in a certain nothingness within self. And I don't think that's probably the case. St. Bonaventure reminds us that anyone who says that they don't believe in God simply doesn't believe in the kind of God that they have heard about or know. They have never encountered the real God, or they would be in many ways so drawn to believe in him that they would be of the faith. And I think that's part of what happens within contemporary society. This is part of the crisis of the church, awash as it is, and this tragic kind of abuse crisis. This is the face of God in the world. This is the face of Christ in the world. These are the words of Christ in the world. I don't think so. And as a young person, I don't think so. And so who are all these people that talk to us about the Christ, about the living God, and then live in such a scandalous way that there is no possibility, there is no credibility for us? But it's not just the abuse crisis. It's the lack of authenticity within Christian life itself that bespeaks this non-affiliated dimension of contemporary society. The story, the very famous story of St. Francis Xavier, who went to the Far East as a missionary, writes back to St. Ignatius in Rome and says he has arrived in Goa, which is a Portuguese colony in India. And he says that he's tried to preach to the natives there concerning Jesus Christ, but the lives of the Christians there are so scandalous that he can make no progress whatsoever, and so he's going to leave there and go to a purely pagan area where there are no Christians to destroy the message of the good news. And when he arrives there in Sri Lanka, modern-day Ceylon, he baptizes 300,000 people and catechizes to the best of his ability with the foundational prayers and sense of what the Catholic Church really is. I think that's the cause of the non-affiliation that takes place within our contemporary society, is that in some way, shape, or form, we have failed to witness to the world what it truly means to be a Christian. And part of that is because we have run the temptation of turning our faith into an ideological posture within the midst of the world and not really living it well in our lives. There's all sorts of struggles and all sorts of issues that we are torn. We have to stand up publicly for such things as the right of a child to live, and for such things as defending the natural order of creation as coming forth from the hands of God. But when we somehow or other see this as the total definition of what it means to be a Christian, then what we have done is we have because not we have not done it personally ourselves, but we have been seduced into the political debates of an unbelieving age, and we are seen then as the rabbinic arguers and debaters of the first century, trying to establish somehow or other a loyalty test, a public loyalty test, in order to we might accept some and reject others. When in fact, every Christian who truly believes in the Lord Jesus Christ does cherish the life that God creates, does honor God's understanding of the natural order, and does honor the understanding that God himself is the author of all life, and that in being the author of all life, he loves and protects all life. But somehow or other, that has to manifest itself in a variety of different ways and not just in causes. And I think that this is part of what happens, that we identify ourselves as Christians through identification with an issue rather than, and I'm not saying that those issues should not be identified, and I'm not saying they should not be debated in the public arena, and they should not be withheld from political debate or anything like that, but I'm saying our relationship to those causes is what becomes important in this whole idea of witnessing to faith and witnessing to the meaning of Jesus Christ in our lives. That when we realize that there is a common humanity, when we realize that humanity is initially coming forth from the hand of God and oriented toward the living God, when we come to understand that, and then we look at ourselves, but this look into the self only works, is only valuable when we truly do know who we are. When we know when we have unjustly blamed others for our misfortunes. And when we know, for instance, that we are capable of failure, capable of error, capable of sin. That in many ways, when we can say, you know, this person has hurt me or I've been treated unjustly or so forth, and can't really look to see, well, how deep is the injustice? How much of this am I a part? It's like taking a criticism. Anyone who doesn't take seriously the criticisms leveled against them is not a humble person. Now, we might reflect upon those criticisms and say they are a result of not really knowing me, or they are the result of bad judgment, that what you have said negative about me simply is not true. But we must be open to the possibility of saying, oh, yes, it is true. And therefore, I myself must heed the critique that has come my way. But we can't know if it's true if we don't know who we are. And this becomes the fundamental platform, then, of our relationship with the living God, our relationship with one another. Who are we? What truly are our faults? What truly are our deficits? And what truly are our strengths? And what truly are our assets? We never need apologize for what we are able to do well. But we should be more than willing to apologize for what we do poorly. We should not have feel the need to apologize for being who we are. But we should not apologize, or we should not somehow or other either justify within us this truth of who we are not. Humility is an interesting thing, and Jesus is talking about that. That's why he has set up the oriental seating structure of a banquet for us to have reference to, because the seating structure is the truth of where the person fits within the society, who they are in relationship to others within that society, socially speaking. Well, he uses that as a metaphor, And he said, and so from that we can draw the fact that each of us has strengths and weaknesses. Each of us has a certain place within the created order. And part of our holiness is the discovery of that place. When we discover the deficits, if we can overcome them, we must. If we cannot overcome them, then we must honestly accept them as something within ourselves which is inadequate. On the other hand, if we have a great strength, we should be able to say, yes, I do have this great strength, and that I should use this for the well-being of others, not necessarily to accrue benefit to myself. And when we therefore look at this particular parable, which in a way is perplexing and seems in a way irrelevant as kind of a commentary on the social mores of the first century Judaism, we begin to understand that it is not that at all. It is a plea, in a way, a teaching from the Lord to be honest about who we are, but first of all, to know that the person that sits up very high when they belong low is someone who doesn't understand who they are or where they fit within the world. The person who sits very low, when they know they should be up high, is either playing a game or has some kind of false sense of who they are, has some kind of a sense of being less than what they truly are, or else they're simply being courteous to others, not to crowd others out of a rightful place, and they're happy to go where they're told to go when everything starts to get settled. In our lives, the same holds true. Those of us who can find out and discover who we are, know the truth of our deficits and know the truth of our faults and our failings and our weaknesses, but also know the truth of our strengths, and therefore do what the Lord has asked us to do, which is to be authentic, have a deep self-knowledge, and have a deep care for the rights and the well-being of other people. These are the things that the Lord is speaking to us about. And when, of course, he goes on to the end about who to invite for your banquet, he's saying that charity and justice, good things, are what is supposed to come naturally to the believer, and that we are not simply to be charitable for the sake of feeling good about it. We are not simply to be charitable so that we have someone to look at and say, let's see what a good boy I am. All the good that I did. We give from the heart and not necessarily from a desire for gratification. That the person who truly knows themselves will be internally generous, and that generosity will be unobtrusive. And that generosity will not be self-serving, and that generosity will not create a sideshow for us to go and observe and see what wonderful things we have done. It is the openness of the human heart in honesty and truth of itself to the human heart of another child of God or other children of God, and giving to them in some way, shape, or form is fulfilling our obligations to our Creator in the truth of the knowledge of the self and in the depth of the goodness of the human heart, for which we were created to expand and explore and live faithfully and strongly in our relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ, both in this world and in the next.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.